This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, our guest will argue it's high time for a new model of government problem solving. We talk to one of the authors of the new book, Bridge Builders. Now, over the weekend, President Biden signed into law a bill that raises the nation's debt ceiling and avoids default. Raising the debt ceiling used to be a routine act of Congress, but this legislation signed by the president was the result of some contentious negotiations between Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. It aims to limit spending and reduce the deficit while raising the country's borrowing limit through 2025. The deal garnered bipartisan support and also some bipartisan criticism from members of each party in the House and Senate. We're checking in with members of both sides of Wisconsin's congressional delegation about their reasons behind their vote on the bill. Gwen Moore is a Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, which covers parts of the Milwaukee metro region, and Rob Ferret spoke with her on Friday.
Can you start us off by telling us why you voted against this debt ceiling bill?
Well, let me just say this. I did not, first of all, appreciate being in a hostage situation. Very obviously, I wanted to pay our bills. I mean, I voted numerous times without fanfare to raise the debt ceiling. Matter of fact, three times under President Trump. And so I didn't appreciate being held hostage to a vote. But had... And I wasn't sure that the Republicans, even after this brinksmanship, would be able to bring a majority to pass their own bill, which, in fact, they were not. More Democrats voted for this bill than Republicans did. I mean, that so much for governing when the party in charge can't scrounge up enough votes to pass its bill. That being said, clearly I didn't want the country to default. And if Hakeem Jeffries had come up and said, Gwen, you're the 218th vote, I need you, I would have done it. But since there were 314 votes, I didn't vote until there were more than 250 votes for yes. It was a good opportunity for me to weigh in about my number one objection to the process. You know, I'm so terrified that, you know, we've started negotiating with terrorists and we might have to continue doing so. This is clearly not regular order. Ordinary legislating, the appropriations committees get together, the budget committee sets targets, you fight, you wrangle, you vote. But here, everyone who voted for it and those who didn't had to make a decision about whether or not to weigh the equities of doing that. You're not going to find a single person, not McCarthy, not President Biden, not Hakeem Jeffries. You're not going to find a single person that says this was some kind of good bill. It's a compromise that was a result of hostage taking.
I think, Representative Moore, one of the arguments is, okay, our debt, our national debt's getting bigger. We've got high deficits year after year. The normal budget process, whatever that is these days, isn't bringing that down. The only leverage a party out of power has is the debt ceiling. This is the only way we're going to cut the deficit. What do you say to that?
Well, I can just say that that's insane, especially when you come to the bargaining table not in good faith. I mean, you're coming to the table and saying we can't take one thin dime away from the richest individuals and corporations. Mind you, mark my words, you know, that before the ink dries on this legislation, Republicans are going to be back trying to get $3.5 trillion in tax cuts to the wealthiest people renewed from this legislation. You know, so much for caring about the debt. And, you know, another one of their really red lines was the work requirement. Oh, we got to have these work requirements. Oh, we've got to fix TANF. And let me just tell you, it seems to me that they wanted the pound of flesh from poor people, low income, mostly Black and brown women, to force them into the workforce. Low wage workforce, they wanted that more than they wanted any savings. Let me just say to you, the plan and policy that they had for changing TANF and disrupting the state's interface with TANF recipients. Fortunately, the White House pushed back on it. But let me tell you, it would have saved them $6 million over 10 years, which, according to my calculation, is something like a 0.000000019 percentage against the $31 trillion debt. Not just hypocritical. But meanwhile, you know, their proposals, literally take food out of the mouths of people. Now, if they were sincere about reducing the debt, they wouldn't come to the table saying, it's non-negotiable. Tax revenue, increasing revenue is not in the cards. Also, they wouldn't be coming to the table immediately taking billions, tens of billions of dollars out of the IRS when we know that there's a half trillion to $1 trillion a year that this country loses in taxes that are owed from people who game the system. And they can game the system because the IRS does not have the personnel and the sophistication to go through tax refunds of these complicated tax returns. And Republicans are helping the wealthiest corporations of people game the system by taking away. So you're not, of course we have to deal with the deficit, but when we have to cut spending and we got to raise revenue, we have to do both those things.
Talking to Wisconsin Representative Gwen Moore about the debt ceiling vote last week. There was talk from some Democrats, Representative Moore, that President Biden shouldn't have negotiated. He should have found another way, including invoking a line in the 14th Amendment that is legally, nobody's quite sure if he'd have the authority to do this. Would you have liked to see in the White House pursue something like that instead of negotiating with House Republicans?
Well, just let me say this. I did sign on to a letter with numbers of other Democrats asking him to explore that. You know, I take their rejection of that to heart. They say that that would have had us caught up in court, that would not have enabled us to meet the deadline of June 1st, June 5th, and June 8th, a day imminent that we were going to definitely default. And maybe it's something that we should take up legislatively or legally to really see, because I don't ever want to be in this predicament again. I don't ever want, one party or one house to be able to blackmail the entire country, put not just our country at risk, but the global economy in decline. I mean, had we defaulted on this, we would have seen people being unable to afford usury rates for mortgages. We would have seen not just Wall Street collapse, but people's 401ks collapse. And for Republicans to have done this, so that they can get, a little bit over $1 billion in COVID money rescissions and to create and to pass, vindictive legislation against poor women, 50, age old poor women, 50 to 54. I mean, women who at that age, are arguably may not be able-bodied, because women who are in that age range and are able-bodied are actually working. Now, these people who are not working have multiple barriers and challenges, and it's a shame that we're forcing old women back into the workforce because, as many of the leaders said during our debate, they want to help small businesses, the kind of businesses that have part-time work and minimum wage jobs and uncertain shifts. They want to force poor people to staff those businesses and to be just happy that they're getting some sort of aid. Else they'll just cut them off from food and Medicaid. Fortunately, the White House pushed back on enabling them to cut these women off of Medicaid.
Representative Moore, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Hey, and thanks for having me.
That was Wisconsin Democratic Congresswoman Gwen Moore from the state's 4th Congressional District. She spoke to Rob Ferret on Friday about why she voted against the bill to raise the debt ceiling, which was signed by President Biden over the weekend. Now, coming up, we'll talk to a member of Wisconsin's Republican delegation about why he voted in favor of the deal negotiated by Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Rob Ferret, and the bill to raise the debt ceiling passed the House last week with votes from all of Wisconsin's Republican representative, with the exception of Tom Tiffany, who joined the state's two Democrats in voting against the bill. In the Senate, Republican Ron Johnson also voted against the bill last week, while Democrat Tammy Baldwin was in favor. We just heard from Democratic Representative Gwen Moore about why she opposed the legislation. Now let's hear from one of the Republicans who supported it. Brian Stile is a Republican U.S. representative for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which goes from the Janesville area over to Racine, as well as Kenosha in southern Wisconsin. And Congressman Stile, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Take us a little bit through your thoughts and why you ultimately decided to vote in favor of passing this debt ceiling deal.
This is a reasonable and sensible bill that takes us one step closer towards fiscal responsibility. It does some substantive things I think are important and a step in the right direction. It limits our spending in the future, in particular to 1% growth going forward, and claws us back to fiscal year 22 spending levels in everything except defense and veterans. That's a step in the right direction, saves taxpayers money. We also claw back unspent COVID funds, approaching $30 billion in money that we can bring back and avoid being wasted. Let's keep that for taxpayers. Let's save that and let's pay down the debt. It also has some pro-growth policies in that are really important. It has work requirements, in particular for able-bodied, childless adults aged 49 to 55. And cleans up a lot of the way that states were gaming the system. Helping people get back to work, we know, is a core aspect of helping people out of poverty. There's nothing more important than a job. This helps able-bodied, childless adults to do just that, to work 20 hours a week if they want to receive welfare or food benefits. The other thing it does is it grows the economy, and in particular, it does that through addressing the permitting reforms that are needed for large infrastructure projects. It doesn't lessen any of the environmental standards. We want to keep our environmental standards high. It just says your federal government needs to do this in a far more efficient way than they were before. And at the end of the day, Republicans and Democrats came together to get this bill across the line. I think if anything, it shows that even in a period of time of hyperpartisanship, in a period of time of divided government, we were actually successful at driving through a deal that's to the benefit of the American taxpayer.
Congressman Stile, some Democrats have accused Republicans of holding the country's financial well-being hostage in order to get what they wanted out of this debt ceiling bill in terms of spending and revenue. And how would you respond to that criticism?
Yeah, there's a lot of hyperbole that people want to throw around. But if we go back at the end of the day, it just took President Biden a darn long time to come to the negotiating table. You got to remember, about 100 days before this bill passed, Kevin McCarthy, Speaker of the House, and President Biden met. Then President Biden changed his tune, refused to meet with Republicans in the House of Representatives, kind of took a real dangerous and reckless position of my way or the highway, no negotiations. It was only as the X day approached that President Biden finally, after doing all sorts of travel to places like Delaware or Japan, changed his tune, came to the table, was willing to negotiate. And at the end of the day, we got a very reasonable and sensible bill that ultimately raised the debt ceiling, which was ultimately needed, but with some fiscal reforms. And that's why you saw a huge number of Democrats and Republicans vote for it. I would say it was pretty darn frustrating that President Biden took a position of no negotiations. That is dangerous and reckless in a period of time of divided government.
Congressman Brian Stile, our guest, joining us this afternoon. I want to ask why this is an aspect of our debt ceiling debates, which now have been pushed until 2025 as part of this agreement, and why this isn't part of the normal budgeting process and a budgeting negotiation as opposed to a debt ceiling debate.
Well, I think the answer to that is pretty straightforward. Unfortunately, so much of our spending is outside of our budget debate. We could just look at the President Biden's unilateral action to spend almost $600 billion by the stroke of a pen attempting to rewrite how student loans are paid for. That was well outside of the budgeting process. I have grave concerns over it. I actually think it's unconstitutional. It was costing taxpayers $5 billion a month every month. That was outside of the budgeting process. Why? Because President Biden took a unilateral action on his own to roughly spend $600 billion. And so many of our spending that we see at the federal government is outside the annual budgeting process. And so therefore, other points in time are when these substantive and meaningful negotiations can occur. This is no way to run a railroad. I'd love to see the federal government sit down and rewrite the process as to how we spend, allocate, and manage taxpayer money. Until that piece occurs, unfortunately, we're left to this kind of odd process that we have, but at least we're using the process to make sure we're doing some what I think are pretty basic things, like clawing back COVID money now that the pandemic is ended.
Representative Style, can the federal government get their spending under control as you see it without at least addressing the non-discretionary spending in the federal budget?
No, it's gonna take an adult conversation as it relates to non-discretionary. So that is about 3/4 of our entire budget is on the non-discretionary side, but 1/4 of it's on discretionary and 1/2 of that's defense. That's kind of a weedy way of saying about 11% of our federal budget is non-defense, not discretionary, non-defense, non-veterans discretionary spending. This is why it's all the more important to have the difficult and adult conversation that the president was refusing to have. The easy path for a lot of politicians is to put your head in the sand. What I'd like to see is us have a far more above board adult conversation about how we protect key programs, in particular Social Security and Medicare, which without addressing will have pretty catastrophic cuts. It's all the more important to have that serious and adult conversation up front.
Lisa from Madison called in to ask about the recent tax cuts and the role that they've played in the debate over the federal revenue and federal spending, Congressman.
And so what she will see is kind of when she digs into the data that we are bringing in the highest percentage of GDP in tax revenue since World War II. Only 2 times in history have we been bringing in this much money. When you make the tax reforms that were made now approaching 5 years ago, what you did is you drove economic growth. Going into the pandemic in particular, we saw real wages rising. Inflation now is eating that away. But going into the pandemic, we're seeing real wages rising. And so total revenue coming into the federal government was increasing dramatically, not by raising rates, but by driving up the amount of income everyone was making. That was positive. Where the challenge is the federal government is spending the highest percentage of GDP it's spent in a long, long time. So Washington doesn't have the revenue problem. We're at some of the highest revenue numbers we've seen. What it has is a spending problem, and we have to address the spending side of the ledger.
Congressman Brian Style, our guest, joining us this afternoon to take a look at the debt ceiling debate, negotiations, and the passage of the bill, which pushes the debt ceiling back now to the year 2025. And Congressman, did you understand that where your colleagues, Congressman Tom Tiffany and Senator Ron Johnson, were coming from in voting against this bill?
Everybody would like a better bill. It's not lost on me. I kind of ascribe to the Ronald Reagan adage of if you can get half a loaf, take half a loaf. I'd offer that this is if you can get a few slices of bread, take a few slices of bread. This does not get our entire fiscal house in order. Absolutely not. Our spending is so far out of control in Washington. It's going to take much more than this piece of legislation. That said, this legislation was the largest spending reduction in history, $1.5 trillion. This bill also had some very positive pro-growth policies like the environmental reforms we discussed or the work requirements that we discussed. And so in my view, is there more to be done? Absolutely. Is this a step in the right direction? Yes, it is. And when I get presented with an opportunity to take half the loaf or a few slices of bread, I'm going to take it.
Congressman Style, what more can Republicans who can now control the House do in conjunction with Democrats in the Senate and this Democratic president before this session is done?
The most important thing that we have coming in front of us is the actual appropriations bills. So we've now set the top line spending number in all the key categories. That's really what a budget bill did. That's kind of what we just agreed to. Here's the top line number. Now, the Appropriations Committee needs to get to work to say, okay, knowing that, what are we going to spend on and what are we not going to spend on? How are we going to prioritize the federal budget. This is what families do in Wisconsin every single month. You sit down with your spouse, you say, here's what we got to spend on, and here's what we'd like to spend on. Let's start to make sure we cover rent and our mortgage. Let's sure we can cover our grocery bill. And then as we get further down the line, maybe let's set a little money aside to do a fishing trip to northern Wisconsin in late summer. Well, what we've seen at the federal government standpoint is they want to spend on everything. And instead of maybe a fishing trip to northern Wisconsin, they want to take a first-class vacation to Europe for summer. What I'm saying is our appropriations committee has got to get serious about what our priorities are. And now that we have a top-line number that actually restricts spending, we have a great opportunity to invest in the area, in the programs that are critical, and actually pull back on spending on programs that aren't delivering at the level people wish they were.
Representative Brian Steil, with the last minute we have left here, where does this debt ceiling deal leave House Speaker McCarthy with fellow Republicans and his power within the overall federal government going forward?
I think what we've shown time and again in just a few short months is that Republicans in the House of Representatives are united. We're able to deliver on key policy wins. And I think this shows the strength in the conservative movement across the board, but in particular in the House of Representatives. Again, this wasn't the end-all, be-all bill, but what it did was a step in the right direction. Everything in this bill was a win for conservatives and a win for taxpayers. And so at the end of the day, I think Speaker McCarthy is well positioned to continue leading in the House.
Does that lead towards more bipartisan agreements in this session?
Well, the only bills that are going to get signed into law while we have divided government is going to require the signature of a Democratic president and passage to a Republican House. And so we have to make sure that we're having the tough conversations, we're negotiating, we're moving the country forward. And so I suspect you'll see additional nonpartisan bills getting across the line.
Hey, Congressman, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Brian Steil, Republican U.S. Representative for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which goes from Janesville, in the Janesville area, over to Racine and Kenosha, with us today to share why he voted in favor of the bill signed by President Biden to raise the nation's debt ceiling. Join us coming up tomorrow on the morning show. The state legislature's influential budget writing committee is in its final weeks of rebuilding their spending plan, and you'll have a direct line to State Representative Mark Bourne, who joins Kate Archer Kent tomorrow morning. Are you a Swiftie or a Deadhead? Well, look what you made me do with all these song titles. Tis the damn season for summer concerts, and Taylor Swift just wrapped up 3 sold-out nights at Soldier Field. Swifties who couldn't score a ticket shook it off and came to Chicago anyway just to sing and dance outside the stadium. An article at FastCompany.com recently argued Taylor Swift is the new Grateful Dead, even though the 33-year-old singer does not have a touch of gray. Now, the Dead were playing in the band at Soldier Field from 1991 to their last show in 95, and comparisons are obvious outside the stadium, from fans who needed a miracle to the vendors on Shakedown Street. Inside the concert industry, the Dead started their own ticketing system, and T-Swift says she might as well do the same after Ticketmaster left Swifties with bad blood this summer. Swift will be trucking up to Minneapolis June 23rd and 24th to bring her Mirror Ball to a sold-out U.S. Bank Stadium, proving she's the one. And the music never stopped. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, the problems governments have to address are more complex than ever. And in order to tackle them, our next guest will argue we need a new model of government altogether that brings us all together. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about family song traditions.
Many of us grow up singing our family's favorite songs. They can carry a deeper meaning if they're rooted in tradition. For writer Jen Rubin of Madison, she's fortunate to have recordings of her grandmother's songs, tapes that were recently called upon during a family crisis.
When I was a kid, we always had shelves filled with blank cassettes. Sony, Memorex, TDK. We had them all. They sat in nice stacks, just laying in wait for me when my grandma called for me to bring her a blank tape and the tape recorder. I dreaded this moment. One minute I was splayed out on the couch watching sitcom reruns, and the next minute I was sitting next to my 75-year-old grandmother and her boyfriend Yaakov, recording them while they sang the Yiddish folk songs. Now, I loved listening to my grandma sing. My grandmother leading our extended family in song during the Jewish holidays as she waved off anyone who tried to harmonize with her when she felt like it was her time for a solo, well, that was the best part of each holiday. But that didn't mean my 11-year-old self wanted her in my living room trying to get me to help her record her songs. They would sing a song, and I would stop the tape, rewind the tape, listen to their voices, and stop the tape. Rewind again, then start the process over. I never understood this. I mean, tape recorders were fairly simple machines in the late 1970s, and these were intelligent people that fled one continent and successfully made their way to another one. At the time, I didn't understand that she didn't really need my help. She wanted me to know the songs of the Jewish diaspora. My grandmother grew up in a shtetl in Russia in the early 1900s. When she was 16, her family fled attacks by the Cossacks and got on a ship to Ellis Island. As a young teenager, her job was to strap a sewing machine on her back, walk miles to town, sew for the Gentile family during the week, and walk home for Sabbath. Family lore has it that it was on those walks that she developed her beautiful singing voice, trading songs with the Russian peasants, returning from the fields, and the Jewish and Gypsy travelers. My first year living in Wisconsin, I decided not to travel back home for Passover. One night, as I was falling asleep, I realized it would be my first Passover without my grandma leading the songs. I was surprised by how bad that made me feel. I called my mom and asked her to get a tape recorder, sit down with grandma, have her sing the Passover songs, and express mail them to me so grandma could lead the songs at my Seder in Madison. A few years later, my grandmother died. And soon after that, we digitized her tapes. A few months ago, I got one of those texts you dread getting. My mom was in heart failure, intubated in the hospital, and it was touch and go. We all rushed to be with her in the hospital. Heart failure can affect breathing, so it was hard for my mom to talk, but she could text. One night, on maybe her eighth night in the hospital, she texted me. She wanted to know if I could find those digitized recordings of her mom singing. She was scared and in pain and thought it would bring her great comfort to have her mother sing her to sleep. At that moment, so many memories flashed through my mind, but it stuck on my sitting on that shag carpet with my grandmother, holding the Sony tape recorder. And now, 40 years later, those tapes are being called into service. I thought about how my mom had been the culture bearer for the younger generations, so we don't let assimilation remove our Yiddish heritage from our lives. And I thought of my mom, frail and alone in a hospital bed, yearning to hear her mother's voice. In a flash of technological finesse I don't usually possess, within minutes, I navigated on my phone to my Google Drive, copied the link to one of the MP4s, and texted my family a recording of Grandma singing. Then we were all silent for a few minutes, in our separate houses, but still together, listening to Grandma sing.
Jen Rubin of Madison brought us that story on the Yiddish tapes. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, how much faith do you have in government's abilities to solve problems? Talking about federal, state, local, there is an argument that change in representation may mean less continuity and new, sometimes completely different reform agendas, and it all results in less overall government improvement. Nothing's getting better. We're talking about how governments can work more collaboratively with outside partners to be more effective and restore public confidence, ours. And our guest has some specific plans to make that happen. And we want you to join us here at 1-800-642-1234. Choose your level of government, local, state, federal. Does it have your confidence or trust? Did it ever? And what's caused you to feel better or worse, or maybe even agnostic about the people in power who are in charge or tasked with solving big problems for big groups of folks? Call us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email always available, ideas@WPR.org. Don Kettle is a professor emeritus, former dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, and a fellow at the National Academy of Public Administration. His books include The Divided States of America and Can Governments Earn Our Trust? Well, can they? He chaired two blue ribbon commissions for Wisconsin state government, one on campaign finance reform and the other on government structure and finance. And his latest book is co-written with William Eggers. It's called Bridge Builders: How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Lee, it is so good to be with you there this afternoon.
I want to start with your optimism in the face of what is a general skepticism about government's ability to get things done. You've been at this for a long time. You've studied this more than most who have an opinion on this. So what keeps you motivated and keeps you talking about it and keeps you coming on to show how we can do it better?
Well, one of the things is it sure beats the alternative, and I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet at all. But one of the things that that both Bill Eggers and I, my co-author, are convinced of is that it's truly possible to be able to make government work better, and in particular to solve some of the really big problems that we're facing. And the reason why we wrote this book was to try to describe how the people who have figured it out have figured out how to do it better. We're just, I think, continually impressed by people who have been out there on the front lines and have found the solutions. And so what we've tried to do in this book, Bridge Builders, is to lay out a strategy that we've been able to be able to steal actually from the people who are actually out there doing this every day.
I want to back you up on that. Bridge Builders, your new book, is not a pie-in-the-sky theoretical design. It is actually looking at when government works and what it is, the common themes that are involved in when government is able to tackle big problems and make things better for a large population of people. So how would you define a bridge builder? Who are they and what do they look like, Don?
The bridge builders are the people who make the connections among all the different players who are responsible for providing the kind of services that we want. We've got a large number of people that we've explored and identified, but one of my favorites is Mike Nichols, who is down here in Texas in Houston, and he's the head of something called the Houston Coalition for the Homeless. And in the course of the last 5 years, they've reduced homelessness by 63%. Now, let me repeat that, 63% in 5 years. This is something that almost everybody agrees is one of the very toughest problems that we have to solve. But the way in which he did it was to try to pull together a very complex set of different kinds of organizations, more than 100 in total, and got them to work together to try to make the ways in which homelessness needs to be attacked work effectively. One of the things that we discovered as we were looking at the book is that so often we tend to think about government as a kind of vending machine where you put some money in the top and you pull the lever and you press the button for the kind of service that you want and then worry about whether or not the service is actually going to come out the other end. What we've discovered is that government is much more like a big symphony orchestra. And it's the matter of trying to find somebody who's an orchestra conductor, which often turns out to be government leaders, who find a way to bring the orchestra together. And if the biggest orchestra we've been able to find is usually about 100 different kinds of people playing 100 different kinds of instruments. But it turns out that there in Houston, they managed to create this enormous progress against homelessness with a group larger than the largest symphony orchestra. That's pretty impressive work. But in the working together, they created truly beautiful music and attacking one of society's very biggest problems.
Well, and as you ask in the book Bridge Builders, Don, what kind of a problem is homelessness? Is it economic? Is it jobs? Is it mental health, drugs, family, criminal justice? Well, what kind of problem is this? And there's no one answer to it, so there can't be any one solution. And that's why you talk about the importance of being outcome focused and how starting with the outcome may be the best place to take your first step, even though that's just the goal.
Well, that's exactly right. And it turns out, Lee, that increasingly the problem of accountability is not a matter of just having people check off the boxes or to try to rattle the bureaucracy from the top down and hope that we're going to be able to get something that comes out on the other end, but instead to try to look at the organization as a place where it's you bring work, the kind of expertise that you need to be able to produce the results that we want. But you define accountability in terms of the entire system's ability to be able to produce the outcomes that we want. And the more that we focus on outcomes and drive everybody to those results, the more effective the system is going to be.
We want to start with reducing homelessness. That is the outcome we're going from, and we work our way back from there. Does that sound about right?
That's right. And one of the other things, too, that they did in Houston was to begin at the beginning by going out and trying to understand what are the basic problems that lead people to homelessness? And they discovered that in some cases, it's mental illness. In some cases, it's drug dependence. Other cases, it turns out to be an economic crisis, like the loss of a job. Sometimes it's being released from prison. Other times, it's a kind of a problem of spousal abuse. And so if we want to try to understand how to fix the problem, we need to understand what problem we have to fix. And then to try to identify the organizations that can be most useful and most effective at being able to produce those kind of results that we want. So it's understanding the government is not just a set of individual bureaucracies that are not connected, but a set of very complex problems we're trying to solve, and where the key is trying to understand how we can bring all the different organizations together that are responsible, that are needed for trying to attack these problems.
Don Kettle, Professor Emeritus, former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, joining us. His new book, which he co-authors with William Eggers, is Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. Join us, 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the solutions that our guest is offering and how government might work better for the lot of us? Do you work in government? Are you a public leader? Do you see yourself as a bridge builder, or do you see other bridge builders out there who deserve attention for the work they're doing? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up our conversation about helping governments figure out how to better solve today's complex problems. And it involves a complicated solution, according to our guest, which brings in all parties who are invested and involved and can come out and are outcome-focused. Don Kettle's Professor Emeritus and former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He's the co-author of the new book, Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries and to Solve Big Problems. I want to talk about trust, Don, and how we build trust in government at a time when trust can be seen as a near nadir.
That's a great question, Lee. And the core problem is that, truth be told, most of us really don't trust the government very much to do what it is that needs to be done, and especially at the big level, what we call in the book the wholesale level of politics. And it's very hard to try to trust a government where we see such incredible polarization. But on the other hand, one of the things that we've discovered is that on the retail level, on the way that each of us interacts with the kind of government agencies that are responsible for delivering the goods and services that we want, what we really want is to have our problems solved. We don't really care who solves them. In fact, we just, if we have a problem, want the problem solved. And the more that we can focus on those problems, the more that we can develop good solutions, the more we can bring together the different organizations that contribute to those solutions, and the more that we can satisfy all of us about the kinds of services that we're getting, to that degree, we can really truly improve service and improve trust in government. I think it's going to be really tough to change it at the wholesale level because there are such huge battles that go back and forth. But at the retail level, that is, at the level where each of us interacts with the government, the more that we can improve service by making sure that fires are put out, to make sure that the snow is removed from the roads, the more that we can try to deal with those issues of homelessness that we were talking about earlier, the more that we can make government work well at the retail level, to that degree, we can build trust one brick at a time in the wall that really constitutes our democracy and the kind of buildings that we use to try to establish the way in which we want government to serve us. And that's something that is fundamentally important. And the good news that we discovered in this book, Bridge Builders, is that it's something that is very doable when we get the right kinds of people in the right places and the right skills to get the job done.
Complex problems would require the government to bring in all parties involved and come up with some complex solutions. So how do you assign accountability that can restore or invest in trust when you have all these parties involved in dealing with and looking for these outcomes?
And that's one of the toughest problems of all. When we start talking about a government that doesn't seem accountable, what it really means too often is that it looks like we've got government agencies that too often are just in business for themselves. But the way to try to bring all of these different organizations together and to define what accountability means is to focus on those outcomes, to focus on what it is that we want the system to do, and then to judge whether or not it's doing it. And one of the things that we've discovered is that one of the easiest way to break down those walls that too often are put up between government agencies is to focus everybody's attention not on process and not on programs and not on who's in control and who's in charge, but rather what kind of problems that we need to solve and who it is that has the assets that we need to solve individual parts of the problem. But the great realization that has come over most of us, I think, is that we're now in a world where there's no one problem that any one organization can control. And that's true. It's not going to change. And so the way to solve problems is not to try to control them, but rather to try to identify who can contribute which pieces to the outcomes that we want to try to produce. And it's making those different pieces work together that creates this kind of symphony that has to constitute the way in which government operates these days.
Don Kettle, our guest. He is a co-author along with William Eggers of the new book, Bridge Builders, How Government Can Transcend Boundaries to Solve Big Problems. And Don, I imagine that good government types would be nodding along with just about everything you have to say today. So what are the impediments here? Where do you see the barriers to getting done a government that provides for better outcomes?
Well, and the good news on the one side is that as we've talked to lots of government officials and lots of people on the inside, you're right, we do get a lot of head nods. We get people saying, yeah, this is the way in which things have to be done. But why is it, if it makes so much sense, that it's so hard to do? And the answer is that in some cases, we've got people who don't want to play along. We've got organizations that want to try to defend their boundaries as if there were barbed wire and deep trenches to make sure nobody could come in. We've got people who are jealous about their own individual power and guarding the money that they've got. We know all of these impediments that unfortunately have built up over the years.
Yeah, so Don, it sounds
like... What we also know is that we've got ways to be able to solve them.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like we're going to have to overcome human nature to the way you describe these problems.
Well, you know, on the one hand, it's the kind of organizational pathology that goes way, 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 way back. But on the other hand, we have a kind of basic philosophy undergirding most of what we're talking about here, which is that most people, when they go to work for a government agency or for any organization, really don't want to say, let me go to work today and see if I can really screw this up. Instead, what people want to do is go and find a way to get their job done.
Yes.
And what we found is that there are strong and effective ways of solving these problems. And it's in many ways just sweeping the barriers out of the way so that they can do what we want them to do and what they want to do.
Don Kettle, you talked earlier about homelessness and how Houston has tackled that and reduced the homeless population with a number of bridge builders like Mike Nichols and bringing in a number of different organizations who are invested in the outcome. With the 2 minutes we have left, can you briefly talk about the biggest thing we're going to have to tackle here in climate change and how we even get started on dealing with something like that?
Now, that's just a great example of a problem that we know that we need to solve and which none of us can solve on our own. And so the key is first to try to sit and understand what is it that we're trying to accomplish? What are the steps along the way? What are the kind of targets that we can set so we can understand whether or not we're going to make any difference? Then we have to understand who is in charge of doing what, so that we can begin to assign responsibility to all the players, whether it's those of us who drive cars and finding cars that are more efficient, those of us who are designing mass transit systems to get more people off the roads and into more fuel-efficient vehicles, and to try to look more fundamentally at the basic issues that would help us to try to clean up the production and factories and manufacturing facilities to make that cleaner as well. It's a matter of breaking the problem down, finding out what it is that we need to do to accomplish the results that we want, to be able to hold each of us accountable for those individual pieces, and use that to try to put all those pieces together to create the results that we want.
And Don, finish where we start here with a few 30 seconds we have left. What keeps you optimistic that we can get there from here?
Well, the best news of all is that I spent lots and lots and lots of time with people who are actually out there doing this. And while on the one hand, we all see these horrific news stories often that talk about the lack of accountability and government's poor performance problems, we've seen far more often, as we start looking, the stories of people who are actually doing a great job, who have figured out how to crack these problems, who have go to work every day and find solutions, whether they're small pieces or even in very big ones, like Admiral Thad Allen, who succeeded in finding ways of trying to battle against the problems that came up with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans.
Don Kettle, will have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Now, coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we're talking about what couples of all kinds can learn from the unique strengths that are found in LGBTQ relationships. We'll look at the science. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time.